You know, when you're walking down a city street and just waiting at a crosswalk, there's this, I don't know, this invisible, almost unspoken contract you make with the world around you.
Right,
You
yeah.
stand on the concrete, the cars stay on the asphalt, and the traffic lights are, well, they're like the ultimate referees.
Exactly.
It feels structured, it feels safe, but when that system breaks down, when that invisible contract gets shredded, the results are just absolutely devastating for you or anyone else on the street.
Oh, totally devastating.
So today we are doing a deep dive into a really sobering legal briefing from the law offices of Norman Gershon. It centers on a harrowing suspected drunk driving crash in Manhattan,
Yeah.
but it quickly expands into basically a masterclass on pedestrian safety, the severe physical risks we face on our shared streets, and really importantly, the aggressive legal roadmap you need when the worst happens.
Yeah, we are essentially unpacking the anatomy of urban pedestrian accidents today. I mean, we need to understand the inherent physical dangers of our city grids and the biological realities of traumatic injuries, and critically, how the legal system attempts to put a price tag on a shattered life when a victim is forced to fight back.
Okay, let's unpack this because to really understand the macro issue, we have to start with the catalyst.
Yeah, the incident itself.
Right. Consider the recent horrific crash on Manhattan's Upper West Side. Specifically, this was that West 109th Street and Amsterdam Avenue. And the facts of this incident are just, they're terrifying.
They really are.
A driver allegedly struck a parked vehicle first, but the chaos didn't stop there. The driver then sped through the intersection, completely jumped a pedestrian island.
Which is crazy to think
I
about.
know, right? An island which is engineered to be a literal safe haven in the middle of the street. And they just plowed into multiple pedestrians. The result, two fatalities and several severe injuries.
Yeah, and the detail about the pedestrian island, that is the key to understanding the sheer violence of this event.
How so?
Well, a pedestrian island isn't just painted lines on the road,
Yeah.
you know, it involves raised concrete curbs. So for a vehicle to jump that curb and continue with enough velocity to cause multiple fatalities,
Right.
that indicates a catastrophic loss of control and immense kinetic energy. I mean, this wasn't a driver just misjudging a right-of-way while turning at 5 miles an hour.
No, definitely not. It's hard to even visualize without getting a chill. The only way I can describe a speeding out of control vehicle in a densely packed New York City intersection is it's like a bowling ball rolling through a crowded hallway where the pins are actual human
Yeah, it's a
lives.
grim image,
Yet
but it's accurate.
there is just nowhere for people to jump out of the way.
Right, and that lack of escape space, it really defines the danger of urban environments. Traffic engineers use this concept of shared limited roadway space.
Shared limited roadway space.
Yeah, because in a dense city, you don't have wide, empty shoulders or grassy medians to bail out into. Every single square foot of asphalt and concrete is highly contested territory.
I mean, you've got delivery trucks double parked, right?
Yeah.
Cyclists weaving through traffic, people running to catch a bus, students walking to school. It's
Exactly.
all stacked on top of each other, and everyone is operating with like inches of clearance.
And let's scale that reality up for a second. This density, it isn't just an Upper West Side phenomenon.
Yeah.
We see these exact high-stakes conditions day in and day out across Manhattan, the Bronx, Queens, and
Oh,
Brooklyn.
absolutely.
But the danger also pushes straight up into the dense suburban corridors of Westchester County, too. Places like, you know, Yonkers, White Plains, New Rochelle, Mount Vernon.
Right.
When you operate a two-ton machine in these specific areas, the required reaction time is measured in fractions of a second. I mean,
Wow.
think about this. A car traveling just 30 miles per hour covers 44 feet every single second.
Wait, 44 feet in 1 second.
Yes. And in White Plains or Brooklyn, 44 feet is an entire crosswalk filled with families. The margin for error is effectively zero.
Which brings us to, honestly, the most frustrating aspect of this entire conversation. I mean, we've had decades of public awareness campaigns and strict law enforcement.
Yeah, we have.
The whole don't drink and drive messaging is completely baked into our culture at this point. Yet these crashes keep happening. So we know alcohol impairs people, but what is actually failing in the brain that turns a city intersection into a death trap?
So, to understand the mechanics of impairment in a city context, we have to look past the generic idea of a driver just, you know, feeling drowsy or sloppy.
Right, it's more than that.
Much more. Alcohol and drugs initiate a total systemic breakdown of the highly specific neurological skills required to navigate a grid. First, it severely disrupts saccadic eye movements.
Saccadic eye movements?
Yeah, that's the rapid eye movements you use to scan an environment.
Blah.
A sober driver's brain constantly processes peripheral visual inputs, right?
Yeah.
Like a dog pulling on a leash or a cyclist in the bike lane.
Or a pedestrian just stepping off a curb.
Exactly. But an impaired driver.
So the impaired driver literally cannot see the full picture.
They can't. They develop severe tunnel vision. The brain simply stops processing those peripheral inputs quickly enough. And second, it ruins the brain's spatial processing.
Meaning what, exactly?
Meaning the driver loses the ability to judge the speed and distance of objects approaching them. So by the time the impaired brain registers that a pedestrian is in the crosswalk, the vehicle has already covered that 24 feet we talked about.
Meh.
It just eliminates the biological ability to make safe decisions or maintain fine motor control over the steering wheel and the brakes.
Well, let me stop you there and push back a little, because this is where I get stuck.
Sure.
We place all the blame on the driver's impaired reaction time. But isn't a massive part of the blame on the fact that pedestrians are just incredibly vulnerable in these specific city layouts?
Well, they are.
I mean, we are forcing unprotected human bodies to share inches of space with heavy machinery. Even a completely sober, perfectly alert driver can sneeze, right? Or have a tire blowout. The design of the city itself almost guarantees that when a mistake happens, it's a tragedy.
I see your point about the unforgiving nature of urban infrastructure. It's a fair point. But legally and practically, the burden of safety absolutely rests on the operator of the heavy machinery.
Because they have the power.
Exactly. The law dictates that you must drive according to the conditions of the road. If the environment is densely packed and inherently dangerous, well, the legal obligation to maintain control increases exponentially.
That makes sense.
But your point about pedestrian vulnerability, that leads directly into the gruesome medical reality we have to discuss. Because when an error occurs, whether from impairment or just negligence, pedestrians have absolutely zero physical protection.
None. I mean, when flesh and bone meet a speeding steel bumper, the physics only go one way.
Yeah, and let's break down the anatomical trauma here. Modern vehicle designs, particularly the proliferation of SUVs and large trucks,
which are everywhere now.
Right. Means the point of impact is much higher on the human body. So when a pedestrian is struck, we consistently see devastating pelvic injuries. The grille of the vehicle acts like a blunt force instrument right at the center of gravity. It crushes the complex ring of bones in the pelvis, which requires massive surgical reconstruction.
And it doesn't end with the initial bumper strike, does it?
No, not at all. The initial impact is really just phase one. The momentum throws the pedestrian onto the hood, into the windshield, and then ultimately onto the pavement.
Right.
And this secondary impact with the concrete, that is what causes severe traumatic brain injuries and spinal cord damage. Furthermore, these collisions cause massive internal bleeding. Organs are essentially rupturing from the concussive force.
Which can be incredibly deceptive for the victim.
Very deceptive.
Because in those first few minutes after a crash, the human body dumps a massive amount of adrenaline into your bloodstream. It's a survival mechanism.
Life.
You might stand up, dust yourself off, and think, oh, I just have some bruises, while you are actively bleeding internally.
And that biological response is precisely why the post-accident roadmap is so critical. If you or someone you love is suddenly thrust into this nightmare, the immediate actions you take dictate both your physical survival and your future legal rights.
So what's step one?
The very first mandate is to seek immediate medical attention. Do not trust your own assessment of your pain levels.
Right, because of the adrenaline.
Exactly. For example, an epidural hematoma, which is a type of bleeding in the brain, it can have what doctors call a lucid interval.
What does that mean?
It means you feel totally fine, you're completely coherent, and then hours later, the pressure builds and you just collapse.
Yeah.
You need advanced imaging from a trauma center immediately.
Wow. Okay, so assuming the victim is stabilized at the hospital, what comes next? Because the scene of an accident in New York City changes in a matter of minutes.
That's the next step,
yeah.
The preservation of evidence. In a busy urban center, evidence decays instantly.
Oh, for sure.
Rain washes away skid marks.
Yeah.
Street sweepers clear debris. But crucially, digital evidence vanishes.
The camera.
Yes. Commercial surveillance footage and residential Ring cameras are often programmed to overwrite their data every 24 to 48 hours.
That fast.
That fast. If someone isn't actively securing that video footage, taking photographs of the vehicle damage, and locking down eyewitness statements with contact information, that evidence just ceases to exist.
And while you are lying in a hospital bed trying to figure out how you're going to pay your mortgage, someone else is actively working against you.
You're referring to the insurance adjusters.
Yeah.
And the fundamental warning in the briefing here is to avoid speaking to any insurance company without legal representation.
Honestly, talking to an insurance adjuster right after an accident, when you are unrepresented and likely on heavy pain medication, it's like playing a high-stakes game of poker against a casino that already knows the cards in your hand.
That is a perfect analogy.
The house is rigged. They are not calling to check on your well-being. They are calling to limit their financial exposure.
Oh, absolutely. They are highly trained interrogators operating under the guise of customer service. They will call you within 24 hours, hoping to get a recorded statement.
Right.
And they will ask a simple, polite question like, how are you feeling today?
And you just say, I'm doing okay.
Exactly. And if you respond with that reflexive, polite, I'm doing okay, they log that as a recorded denial of severe injury.
Unbelievable.
They use your own social conditioning against you to devalue your claim.
So what does this all mean for you financially as the victim? What are you actually fighting for when you go up against these massive corporate entities?
You are fighting for the mathematical reality of a ruined life. The financial compensation victims are legally entitled to pursue is incredibly comprehensive because catastrophic injuries have a massive economic footprint.
Right. The bills pile up fast.
It starts with the obvious stuff: emergency room bills, surgeries, rehabilitation. But the larger fight is about the future.
How do you even calculate the future cost of an injury?
That's where forensic economists and life care planners get involved. Say a victim suffers a traumatic brain injury and requires round-the-clock nursing care. That is calculated over their remaining life expectancy, accounting for healthcare inflation.
Wow.
Then there is lost wages and the loss of earning capacity. If a 35-year-old union electrician suffers a spinal cord injury and can never work in their trade again, the lawsuit has to calculate 3 decades of lost wages.
Plus missed promotions, lost pension contributions.
Exactly. Add to that the compensation for physical pain, emotional distress, permanent disability, and of course, in cases of fatalities, wrongful death claims filed by the surviving family.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. We've outlined the trauma, the physics, and the financial stakes, but knowing your legal rights is completely different from actually enforcing them.
Oh, 100%.
Going up against a multi-billion-dollar insurance conglomerate or a massive municipal entity requires a highly specific type of advocate.
It requires a trial lawyer. The legal field is vast, and, you know, many personal injury attorneys operate on a volume model.
Meaning they just take whatever they can get.
Pretty much. They take on hundreds of cases and settle them quickly for whatever the insurance company offers, just to avoid the expense and risk of a trial. But insurance companies keep meticulous data.
Oh, I'm sure they do.
They know exactly which lawyers are afraid of the courtroom and which ones actually try cases to verdict.
And that brings us to the profile of the attorney behind today's briefing. The source material highlights Norman Gershon, who has spent over 35 years representing injury victims across Westchester County in New York City.
Yeah.
And the phrase that absolutely jumps off the page is his reputation in the legal community. He is known as the attorney other lawyers call to try their toughest cases.
That's huge. Because when peer attorneys, people who intimately understand the complexities of trial law, when they view someone as the ultimate closer for the most difficult high-stakes cases,
yeah,
it tells you everything up at their skill level. And the track record backs up that reputation with cold, hard data. I mean, the verdicts and settlements secured by his firm are staggering. They really reveal the sheer scale of the legal battles involved in these catastrophic crashes.
Walk me through some of those specific numbers, because I think it proves what happens when you actually hold these entities fully accountable.
Okay, look at the Transit Authority cases alone. These are notoriously difficult because municipal entities have massive legal defense budgets.
Right.
Yet the record shows a $16.5 million verdict in Betancourt v. NYCTA.
Wow.
And a $14.5 million settlement in Lynn v. Metropolitan Transit Authority.
You don't get $16.5 million from the MTA by asking nicely.
No, you do not.
That requires completely dismantling their defense experts on the stand.
Exactly. And beyond the transit cases, the corporate and vehicular liability verdicts are equally massive. There's a $5.445 million verdict in Mungo v. Treviso, a $5.068 million verdict against a corporate entity in Young v. Ball and Nissan Lyft of NY. Also a $3.75 million verdict in Hernandez Santos v. Egg Depot, Inc., and a $3 million verdict in Carmona v. Ester Transportation, Inc.
It also highlights specific local jurisdiction wins, too, right? Like the $2.5 million verdict in a Westchester motor vehicle accident, Yurkovich v. Suppen.
Right. And what is vital to understand here is that these multi-million dollar figures are not lottery winnings.
No, not at all.
They are the calculated, fiercely litigated cost of lifelong medical care and lost potential. They represent a victim whose life was altered by negligence, who refused to accept a lowball settlement, and who had an advocate willing to take the fight all the way to a jury.
Yeah, and the client testimonials in the briefing really paint a vivid picture of what that fight looks like from the inside. One client describes him as a brilliant attorney, a beast in the courtroom.
I love that quote.
Right. Another simply states, "He got me a settlement I never thought possible." The briefing really emphasizes a commitment to meticulous preparation and intense responsiveness.
Yeah. And importantly, it highlights the contingency fee structure, meaning you only pay if you win.
Which is so critical.
It really is. Mm-hmm. It means victims who are financially devastated by an accident can still access elite legal firepower without paying out of pocket. For anyone navigating the nightmare of a crash in NYC or Westchester, the firm makes itself highly accessible, providing the direct line at 914-485-1444.
So, if we synthesize everything we've analyzed today, this legal briefing serves two profound and simultaneous purposes.
Okay, what's the first?
First, it is an uncompromising warning to every single person operating a vehicle in our region. Whether you are navigating the dense, chaotic grids of Manhattan, Queens, or the Bronx, or driving through the busy suburban arteries of Yonkers, New Rochelle, or Mount Vernon.
The physics do not care about your intentions.
Exactly. A split second of impairment or distraction can turn a vehicle into a lethal weapon.
And the second purpose is the legal lifeline.
It provides a structured framework proving that when the worst does happen, victims are not entirely powerless. You don't have to accept the narrative pushed by an insurance adjuster.
Right.
There are robust, highly aggressive legal mechanisms designed to shift the financial burden back onto the negligent party.
It's all about leveling the playing field. A severely injured pedestrian cannot physically or financially fight an insurance corporation alone. They just can't.
No.
They need the threat of those multi-million dollar verdicts to force a fair resolution.
It really brings us full circle. We started today looking at a heartbreaking tragedy on Amsterdam Avenue, a violent reminder of how fragile our illusion of safety is when a driver chooses to get behind the wheel impaired.
Yeah.
We explored the dense, unforgiving architecture of New York City and Westchester County, where pedestrians are forced to exist mere inches from heavy machinery. We dove into the biological realities of blunt force trauma and the absolute necessity of immediate medical intervention.
And we also exposed the psychological tactics of insurance companies aiming to minimize payouts, right? Along with the immense mathematical complexity of proving lifetime damages in court.
Right. And finally, we examined the caliber of legal advocacy required to actually win these fights, analyzing the multi-million dollar track record of a lawyer that other attorneys call when the stakes are at their highest.
Yeah.
So the next time you are standing at a crosswalk or driving through one of these busy intersections, keep the physics of our shared spaces in mind. Stay hyper-aware. And remember the critical steps to take and who to call if that invisible contract of safety ever shatters.
Which leaves us with an important question to consider today. If our densely packed cities naturally put unprotected pedestrians in such incredibly close proximity to fast-moving machinery, do these massive multi-million dollar legal verdicts actually force society and corporations to fundamentally change their driving and safety behaviors? Or are they simply placing a necessary post-crash price tag on the inherent, unavoidable risks of urban life?